Today's Teisho will be on case 65 in the Book of Serenity, Shushan's New Bride. Case, tut tut, pshaw pshaw, stripping, removing, puff puff, whoosh whoosh, vague, confusing, impossible to chew, hard to approach. Tell me, what story is this? Introduction. A monk asked Shushan, "What is Buddha?" Shushan said, "A new bride rides a donkey. The mother-in-law leads it." Verse. The new bride rides the donkey. Her mother-in-law leads it. Their appearance and style are indeed natural. How laughable, the neighbor girls imitating the frown. To other people, it increases ugliness. Does not make beauty. Today is day two of our sesshin, and what a lovely morning. After that hot weather yesterday, this morning was cool and refreshing. It's really wonderful when that happens. It's really a stroke of luck, isn't it? Yesterday was so hot, and today it's probably 15 degrees cooler, maybe 10 degrees cooler. It's just delightful. We had a gentle rain this morning. And just beautiful day. Everybody has been doing a wonderful job. This morning we're all sitting quietly here in the Zendo. The three sits in a row. Everybody's doing just an excellent job. And so everything is prepared for us to walk this beautiful path together. This facility is still here. You were able to find the time to come. Even the weather is cooperating with us. It's just wonderful. And everybody's making an excellent effort. Really a great pleasure. So today is day two of the sesshin. And some of you are probably feeling a little bit tired. Generally, day one is a day when people come with all kinds of expectations, ideas, maybe fantasies. You often come here with, people often come here with lots of baggage from their daily lives. You know, typically on day one of a session, people are sitting and thinking about issues at home or issues on the job. And then on day two, people are just trying to survive, right? Just trying to survive. And that's such a better situation. It's so much better when people are in that state of mind where you're just trying to get through the next sit, right? That's so superior. And you might say, well, why? Why is that superior? You know, you might feel less astute mentally. You might feel less clear mentally. And you may not be tired at all, which would be a great pity. You know, the whole structure of sesshin is designed to wear down the small self. So if you had a really resilient small self, it could be a real problem. But there's a real advantage to wearing down the small self. And it's connected to a question somebody asked me last night in Dokusan. You know, what happens in Dokusan is always supposed to be confidential. And it's just between you, me, and enlightened mind. And it's probably a good idea not to talk about it to anybody. But, you know, I don't think this person will mind if I mention that the person came into the room and he said, you know, what are these koans anyway? Why are we doing these koans? I thought that was probably a question a lot of people had on day two of the session, or maybe the evening of day one. It's like, what are these crazy koans? You know, or why are we doing them? When you read them out loud, why do they never make any sense at all? Yesterday said, what's the head? He said, the head is when you look and you don't even know it's dawn. Huh? And today is another kind of crazy koan. Something, what's Buddha? The new bride rides a donkey, mother-in-law leads it? What the heck? All of this is connected to what's supposed to be happening at Sesshin, by the way. So let me just explain that the koans are an innovation that was developed in China, probably not in India, although we're not sure, we don't really know. But probably not in India, probably were developed in China. But something important had already happened in India that made the koan, the appearance of koans, a pretty predictable, pretty necessary event. You know, when the Buddha was growing up, we don't really know that much about the Buddha's life because his life story is surrounded by legend. Whether or not the Buddha was actually the son of a king or a local chieftain or something like that, we don't know for sure. But it does seem likely that if the Buddha became troubled by life, if he was suddenly aware of the insecurity and instability of existence, he would have gone to study with what were called at the time, and they're still called, isn't it, the rishis, with the rishis. Some of you are young enough, or old enough, rather, to remember the Beatles. And the Beatles used to study with a famous Indian guru named Maharishi. And he was called Maharishi, great rishi. And he was a particular, I think it's Maharishi. And he was part of this ancient tradition of forest-dwelling ascetics. These were people who lived in the forest and practiced meditation. And if the Buddha had wanted to achieve something like liberation or insight, it makes sense that he would have gone to study with the rishi, which is what he did. He studied with two very famous meditation masters at this time. And then he was unsatisfied with their teaching because he didn't feel that it actually provided true enlightenment. He felt that it provided release from suffering, but he thought that there was something more than release from suffering. And so he continued to search on his own with some companions. And he eventually had experience of what he called the deathless. And he said, I've really come face to face with the deathless. And then he set out to teach this path to people, first to people he knew and then people who heard about him. But the thing is that his teaching basically had two parts. First, he taught what you might call mental calming the mind. And this is shamatha. This is mental stabilization or mental tranquilization. You know, if you're really nervous, if you're really fearful and distracted, you can't be very alert. When I was a kid, I used to have a lot of trouble with math. Like many people in the United States, I was terrified of math. And I started taking Algebra 1, and I would fail every test for the first couple of months of Algebra 1. And finally, when I would go in to take a test or a quiz, I would be so nervous I couldn't even think straight. I was like a frightened chicken, you know, just running in every direction. In my mind, I couldn't even focus on the numbers. So the Buddha said, you know, first of all, before we try to understand anything, we've got to have a stable, focused mind. And stable, focused mind under almost any circumstances is a great gift. So first part of meditation practice is shamatha, calming the mind. And this is true for us too. I mean, part of what has to happen in the sesshin is you have to get a calm, stable mind. When you are practicing at your home, you might not realize how shallow your concentration really is. Now, it's possible to sit for 20 minutes and feel so much better, so much happier. And that's wonderful. But your actual state of mental, your actual mental condition is still very shallow and distracted, as a matter of fact. You know, when you come here to sit, you know, you're watching the breath or you're working with your koan. But yesterday we did this for 8 hours. And today we're on our, let's see, we did 2 hours this morning, an hour, three. So, you know, we've done 11 hours of meditation in the last day and a half, a day and one morning. And what happens is that the mind begins to really become still and calm, and really quite still. Your mind is already much more calm and still than it was when you came here yesterday. There may be still lingering thoughts from your work or your family life and so on, but there are probably fewer of those, and your mind is probably much more focused on the moment. And it might just be focused on the discomfort of the moment, but actually that's a huge gain, because your mind is probably, even though you might be experiencing physical discomfort, your mind is probably much more still and calm than it was yesterday. And nothing can be achieved if the mind is in a straight state of distraction or fear or attachment. So first thing is just to calm the mind. So important. That was the first thing the Buddha taught. And then the second thing the Buddha taught was observing. So first thing is shamatha, and the second thing is observing. So when the Buddha said, when your mind is stable and calm and focused, and thoughts are no longer intruding, or emotions are no longer intruding, you can see things just as they are. And then you want to observe, and the Buddha actually just taught a kind of observing the moment from moment to moment. So he taught sitting on the cushion until you enter samadhi. Samadhi is the state of mind in which your mind is focused and balanced and calm. And then he taught vipassana. So shamatha and calming the mind, and then vipassana, observing. And this is the foundation of all Buddhist meditation practice. And we do this too. When we watch the breath, you're calming the mind and observing the breath. When you work with a koan, you have to have a calm mind to work with a koan. You need to go into deep mushin, we say, deep emptiness. And then you observe. And the koan is asking you to observe something. Now, in early Buddhism, it was probably the case, and it's still the case in, say, Vipassana, that the teacher will actually say, look at something. I want you to notice something today. And in fact, even in Zen, sometimes teachers do that. My teacher sometimes would say, I want you to try this. You know, pick out a sound. We were sitting once where there were lots of birds. And the birds would just sit there and go, for hours. He'd say, pick out one sound that's very repetitive. and just listen to it. And it doesn't have to be a bird. It could be the katydids outside, right? You know, that sort of electric sound. You can listen to that. He just says, listen to that and tell me what happened. You know, so indeed it was quite an amazing experience. So, you know, probably in early Buddhism, the instruction was like that. It was enter a deep calm, deep mental calm, and in that state very few thoughts are arising, and you're very focused on the moment. And when you're in that state, then you can observe. See? And the teacher would probably direct the student. So this is pure Buddhism. This is the pure teaching of Siddhartha Gautama. And all Buddhist meditation is built on this foundation. But Zen was kind of a departure in some ways from this, because the truth is, it's very difficult sometimes for people to observe the moment without their fears and attachments getting in the way, even if they are in a relatively deep state of samadhi. So the truth is that people are not really a blank slate when they come to do meditation practice. If people were a blank slate, that would be great. It would be much simpler if people could just come in, calm the mind, see reality, have enlightenment, you know, bing, 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 beautiful. And the Buddha basically taught a kind of meditation that was really aimed at people who were able to do that, more or less, actually. And in fact, you know, if you read the Pali Sutras, the Buddha said, if you follow my method, you will have Daikensho in 7 years. That's what he said. Yeah? Now, you know, teachers of Vipassana today, if you ask them, well, I've been practicing for 7 years, where's the Daikensho? They'll say, well, you know, that was sort of the ideal case, you know. The truth is that probably some people the Buddha was dealing with were able to have Daikensho in 7 years. The Buddha took 6 years to wake up. But generally speaking, human beings have a hard time waking up because they have these psychological obstacles that they carry with them. And now, it's possible that not everybody has these. There are people, actually, even in the world today, who have Daikensho after just a couple of years of sitting. This woman, Maura O'Halloran, this American woman of Irish extraction, went to Japan and studied with a teacher named Go Roshi. Go was a Japanese word, it doesn't mean like go. Go Roshi. And basically, she had Kensho, Daikensho, in 2 years. And everybody said, how did you do it? And she just said, well, you know, just do what the teacher said. You know, I calmed the mind, I observed, and I saw enlightenment. But most of us are not in that situation. You know, we come with the psychological obstacles that we aren't aware of, right? Because you can't see your hidden fears and attachments, or you don't want to. And so the koans system is designed to help you break free from these attachments and obstacles, and also to draw on the power of the unconscious mind. You know, let me just say that I think everybody has, or most people have, these psychological obstacles. You know, every once in a while, people will come to Sesshin and they'll leave Sesshin. And if this happens to you sometime, you should always know, I understand, and I'd be happy to see you again, and I would love to have you come back. Just because you leave Sesshin doesn't mean that the door is closed on you or something like that. But it's interesting to see people's faces when they leave sashin. Sometimes people will come in to see me in Dokusan. It usually happens on day 3 of the sashin, sometimes sooner. And people's faces are like a mask of fear. It's like, I'll look at somebody's face. They'll come into the Dokusan room and I'll already know in a way. It's like their bags are packed. Because they're just so afraid. And you can't reason with people who are in that state. Their unconscious fears are washing over. You know, they don't even know why they're afraid. They're just afraid. And so you just have to say, okay, you know, keep practicing. But all people have those. We all have these sort of, most people, I guess Maura O'Halloran didn't, but most people have significant obstacles. You know, we might have had things in our lives that have closed up many doors inside of ourselves. You know, people have been humiliated, they've been physically brutalized, or they've been locked into relationships with other people who have dominated them, or, you know, this goes on and on. And we all have these sorts of things. It's very difficult to get through those. So the koan, part of the function of the koan is to help people break through these barriers. Help people break through these barriers. And so a koan here's a koan for you. There's a famous koan about a teacher is going to give a dokus, going to give teisho. And the blinds are, they're down. And the teacher wants more light in the room, so he points to the blinds. And two monks see him point to the blinds, and they look at the blinds. They're identical monks, right? Both of them have about the same height, same weight, no hair, you know, robes, blue robes. They both get up, rush over, each of them grabs a string, and each of them raises the blinds at the same time, right? So identical monks, both get up, both go over, both raise the blinds, okay? And the teacher looks at the two of them, they both look at the teacher, and he points to the first one and he says, one hit, you did it right. And then he points to the second one and says, one miss, you didn't get it right. So that's the koan. So at first this just sounds like another crazy story. It's like, well, so what's this all about? If you enter deep samadhi and then you enter mu and your mind becomes empty and blank, you start working with this koan, you may find that emotions come to the surface that are quite forgotten, but are very powerful. Sometimes this happens, not always. But you know, we all hate to be the loser, right? We want to be the winner. We don't want to be the monk that the teacher says, you don't have it. We want to be the one who has it. You know, in our fantasy, here's so many people I've run into have fantasies about their previous reincarnations, right? And some people want it sometimes. It's amazing. Somebody say, I understand you teach Zen. Are you a Buddhist? Yes. You know, I think I was so-and-so. And it's like, okay, great. You know, great. And another fantasy people have, and I have to confess that I sort of had this too, you know, when the Dalai Lama came to our Zen center many years ago, I was just starting to practice. And I have to tell you the truth. You know, I had a little fantasy in my mind where he'd come to the Zen center, he'd look over and see me, and he'd go, Lama Dorji, you're back, right? You've got to come to Tibet with me right away. Yeah. That's the fantasy, right? That's the fantasy. I knew, I was looking all over the world for you. Here you are in Seattle at the Seattle Zen Center. And I might not be able to answer my koans, but I'd be taking off with the Dalai Lama, right? So that was my fantasy. Right? Nobody wants to be the monk who doesn't answer the question right, or do the task right. We don't want to be the loser. We want to be the winner. So the koan begins to open up a lot of these things, and it's very important. I mean, one of the reasons people can't wake up is they're trying so hard to wake up and they're so afraid of not waking up. See, they're trying so hard to be enlightened, and the harder they try, the more they close the door on natural mind. So the koan is really bringing all this out. It's like medicine for your mind. See, so koans don't operate, however, on a conscious level. If the teacher, if you went in to see the teacher and the teacher just says, you know, I think you're trying too hard. Just try to be more natural. See, you can go back to your cushion and you can say, okay, I've got to be more natural. What does that mean? How would you do it? I don't know how to be more natural. I already don't have any shoes on, you know, so I can't be more natural by taking off my shoes, you know. What would it mean to be more natural? You know, the conscious mind can't really solve that problem. See, telling somebody this is the situation and here's what has to happen doesn't really necessarily help them very much, because we think that the conscious mind is our real self. We think our conscious mind, the little self, is the real self. Little mind is the real mind. But that's not so. At least in Zen, we don't think that's so. The conscious mind is like the proverbial tip of the iceberg. Right? There's an iceberg under that tip, and it's massive. And that's your unconscious mind. That's your unconscious mind. And so, you know, when people try to answer these life issues, or resolve these life issues using the conscious mind, it's almost hopeless. Because the conscious mind is so small, and its ability to change the deeper self is so limited. So the koan just doesn't even deal with the conscious mind. It just sort of says, you can't help. We know you want to help, but you can't help. So it tells a little story about two monks. Right? It says, one hit, one miss. And you go back and you sit with that. It makes no sense to the conscious mind, but to the unconscious. It's beginning to fall down into the unconscious mind like a stone thrown in the well. And it begins to work its magic. See? And the unconscious mind can deal with things that the conscious mind can't. It's much more subtle, much more sophisticated, much more inclusive. And, you know, people might not necessarily believe this. You know, people don't necessarily believe in the power of the unconscious mind, but it's extraordinary. You know, every once in a while you'll read these stories, and I think they're true. You know, you'll read these stories about, I remember about 10 years ago reading this story about this guy who lifted a car off of this little girl. It's like there was a car accident and this little girl was like a pedestrian or something, and she got hit. And a car was on top of her. He lifted the car. And after it was over, people said, how did you do that? You know? Well, I think people can do that sort of thing when they call on the big mind. It's like there's this bigger self, this reservoir of energy in there. And I think people in crisis sometimes do tap into this, because it's like life and death. You know, there are people who are like this case of this guy who lifted the car off a little girl. There are people who are in crisis and they have to act decisively, and later they'll say, I don't know how I did it. I don't know how I did it. I walked for 10 days without any food or something like that. And I was, they'll say, I was in a trance. I don't even remember what happened. This is common, relatively common. So what happens, I believe, in those moments when people are tapping into this deep, what happens in these moments is that people are tapping into this deeper self, this deeper energy. And so, in the history of Buddhism, koan practice is trying to tap into that deeper mind and use it as an ally in the struggle for liberation and awakening. And so, koan practice is really aimed at something deeper than consciousness, something deeper than small self. And it's going to use the power of the unconscious to liberate you. That's what we're up to. Unconscious mind is able to do vipassana better than the conscious mind. The conscious mind may or may not be able to notice what's happening in the moment, because it's only looking for what it already knows, and it isn't looking for what it doesn't want to find. The conscious mind's always looking for what it already knows, and it doesn't look for what it's afraid to find. But the unconscious mind is a bigger mind. It can see what the conscious mind can't, and it can deal with what the little mind is too scared to deal with. Shushan's new bride. A monk asked Shushan, "What is Buddha? What is Buddha?" Shushan said, "A new bride rides a donkey. The mother-in-law leads it." So, makes no sense, as usual. So we sit on the cushion. If this were our koan, if it's not your koan, please don't work on it. Work on the koan you're working with. But someday we may have the chance to do this koan together. And if it's your koan, just sit down and you would, there's two parts. So the first part is the new bride. New bride, new bride, new bride. Well, you know, sometimes I feel like a bride. I do. In the last sit, I felt like a bride because I was clear and pure and cool. Yesterday was so hot, and so sitting was difficult. And everybody on day one of Sesshin has a tumultuous mind. It's burning with the thoughts. It's burning with the fear. It's burning with the expectations. Like the Buddha said, the eye is burning, you know. The ear is burning, the mind is burning. Absolutely so. It's like a bonfire of attachment and anxiety all the time. And that when things happen to us that scare us, it makes the fire burn even higher, and even hotter. And we go through these fires all the time. You know, this incredible fire. If you sit on the cushion and you watch the breath for 8 hours, and there's going to come a time, maybe it won't come today, but it'll come, when all of a sudden it's like the fire is out. Yeah? And it's like a placid lake, your mind is like the surface of a placid lake. And you're cool, and your mind is cool and bright. And refreshed. It's just like when the weather changed this morning, only it changes inside you. Could be 90 degrees and you could still feel this way. It's not dependent on the weather outside, it's the weather inside. When you have a problem, when you have a koan, you're working, 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 tension builds, pressure builds, this is natural. But sooner or later, you're going to have like explosion, and all the obstacles are going to be blown away, and then you're going to be calm and clear. Calm and clear. And this is the most beautiful state. If you walk this path for a long time, you'll recognize this state again and again. Calm, clear, cool mind. No obstacles. Mm-hmm. This is like being a new bride, right? Everything's new, everything's fresh. Beautiful. But what about the mother-in-law? That's the second part of the koan. What is Buddha? A new bride rides a donkey, and the mother-in-law leads it. See, now that's interesting. I hope if you get married, I hope you like your mother-in-law. And I hope you like your father-in-law. I love my wife very much, and I have been married for more than 30 years now. I guess just 30 years. But I did have trouble with my mother-in-law, I have to tell you. And I had trouble with my father-in-law too, but I was able to avoid him more easily. My father-in-law is like a gun nut, you know? So when I would go visit my in-laws, he would always say, "Hey, do you want to go shoot guns at the range?" And he was a very kind man, you know? So I would go out and shoot these guns all day. It's like, you know, sometimes I felt like shooting myself, you know? It was so boring. And I only hit the target like once in all the times we went out there. I hit it the first time. He gave me a handgun. And he said, "Just point and squeeze," and I hit and knocked. These are metal targets that are on these posts. These posts come out of the ground, and there's a little flat place on top, and they put the metal object, and you walk away, and you know, a certain distance, standard distance, and then you shoot. I aimed the gun, I knocked it right off. I thought, "Oh, the Zen power is really something else." No, I never hit it again, ever. You know. So anyway. You only have to do that once a year or something like that. But my mother-in-law was very difficult to deal with, you know. It was difficult for my wife, much more difficult than for me. Because she had a kind of, she's a very fearful person. And she kind of took her anxieties out on other people. This world is full of such people. She could be very cutting, actually, very biting. And a hypercritical person, very unhappy person. So dealing with her was quite difficult all the time. And even when you do her a kindness, she'd sort of bite at you, you know. So that's difficult. And I don't know how my wife ever managed to grow up and be such a nice person. But, nobody likes a mother-in-law who gives them a hard time all the time. Nobody likes pain in your legs. Nobody likes these experiences in life which have closed so many doors in ourselves. But these obstacles are really essential to our awakening. Essential. Now, we all love the pure, cool mind, but the only way to get there is through the mother-in-law, believe it or not. You know? It's the mother-in-law in life. And, you know, this is kind of a sexist poem. We could say the father-in-law, the overbearing father-in-law. So we could turn it around and say, you know, you have to go through the father-in-laws in this world. Some people have a very nice father-in-law, and that's great. And as I said, mine was okay, just once a year at the rifle range. And otherwise, okay. But, you know, these obstacles we have, we grew up with them. We have to deal with them. We have to work through them. Cannot run away. And if you run away, you'll run forever. Right? Run forever. Now, I am sort of haunted by the faces of people who leave Sesshin, because they come in and it's like a mask of fear. Oh my gosh, look at the fear in that person's eyes. The only way to break free from that fear is to do what you're doing. There's really probably no other way. Use your power of breath, use your move to sweep away these obstacles and liberate yourself. But you need the obstacles. these blessed obstacles, these wonderful obstacles. This is like the, this is how you wake up. You need them, and they're going to be responsible for your awakening. So it's a crazy world, but very wonderful, very beautiful. So today you have, fortunately, plenty of obstacles left. It's cooler, so that obstacle's gone, but many of them. Tired, you know, legs hurting, back hurting, whatever. Beautiful, right? Beautiful. Go back to your breath, sweep them away, sweep them away. And sooner or later, this beautiful, what happened today in outside is going to happen to you inside. And the heat's going to go away and you're going to be in a cool, calm mountain valley in your heart and mind. So just keep going, please.